All right, here. There's a smooches for Patreon, and then what do I do for Substack people? I guess they get smooches.
They get a smooch too. Yeah,
we have literally Substack person right now, don't we?
We do. That'll grow. So it's recent. It'll grow.
Yeah. And everybody's equal. Everybody's equal. Everybody's copacetic. We're all in the same drum circle. Substack, Patreon.
Love it.
We get support through PayPal too, which is so awesome. I love seeing that.
That's very cool.
I hope everybody here is having a wonderful Lent. If you observe, I hope if spring is starting where you are, you're having a wonderful spring. It's kind of vaguely whispering in our ear. How's it there, Aldis? Is it something?
It was getting really nice, and then it got cold again in the last week, and it's going to be cold next week. So,
I was in far northern Michigan earlier this week, and it was 65 degrees and sunny one day, and then we went to bed and woke up in the morning and it was 12 degrees and everything was covered with an inch of ice. So
I really shouldn't complain, because it got cold again, but it didn't get Midwest cold.
We definitely want to talk about this free Masonic stuff, but let me talk about alchemy for a second, because I've got something that I think is fascinating. You know, we touched on alchemy in the core episode, and I think sometimes people can be very dismissive of alchemy. It's sort of like, you know, this wonky attempt at doing science or something, but it doesn't really mean anything. Another project, I got very interested in the history of mining. Okay. And the earliest mines were all ochre mines. And people who are familiar with ochre, it's got this rust pigmentation, and it used to be used for cave art and body painting and all these other things. And then I found in this book, it's kind of a pop sci, sort of a cheesy thing. If you're interested in it, it's worth checking out. This book called The First Signs by Genevieve von Petzinger. And basically what she did is she went into all these these places where there are cave art, and she tried to figure out sort of what is the grammar of all of these very, very old, you're talking 40,000-year-old symbols, right? Were they trying to say something? What are these, and why do we see some of the same stuff in some of the same places? She has this bit in here that she does not, I don't think, recognize the significance of, but it leapt out at me. So, as we talked about in the core episode, and I got a quick little quote here. Alchemists have generally divided the great work into three distinct phases, referred to by their color: the negredo, black phase; the albedo, white phase; and rubedo, red phase. In earlier times, some also spoke of the citronatus, the yellow phase, that was said to occur between the white and red phases. Now, check this out. This is from, again, this book, The First Signs. I'm just going to read this quote. Quote, the cave in which we are particularly interested is known as Pinnacle Point 13B. This is in South Africa. Starting around 160,000 years ago, the people living here began collecting pieces of ochre. That's right, 160,000 years ago. As with earlier people at the Twin Rivers site in Zambia, they weren't just picking up any piece of ochre. They were very selective in their color choice, and bright, saturated red hues were their favorite. If they couldn't find the color they wanted, they altered the natural shade of pigment by heat treating it. Somewhere along the line, they discovered that if you heat up pieces of ochre to a certain temperature and for a particular length of time, the color changes. Yellowish ochre becomes red. Red ochre becomes redder and darker. They may not have had a word for chemistry yet, but that is exactly what they were doing. And she talks elsewhere that as this refined, they would later figure out how to make the ochre white, and they would figure out how to make the ochre black. And so I literally think that the roots of alchemy go back at least 160,000 years. And what it meant to those people is very difficult for us to say. I mean, it's very much lost in the sands of time. But I actually think the tradition of alchemy is older than maybe anything else that human beings did that you can define as human, right? I just find that utterly fascinating. And so it's easy for us to dismiss this now. It's like, oh, this is like this wonky medieval thing that people were doing. I think it's like at the core of humanity somehow. So it wouldn't surprise me if the alchemical practices going on were like consistently practiced up to from 160,000 years ago or older up to, you know, the medieval era. So I just wanted to put that out there because I find that subject utterly fascinating.
Well, and Aldous, tell me, isn't the name for ancient Egypt, wasn't it the land of Chem? And it was the black
that
soil
exactly
and
what I was
all that
of.
Kind of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that true or is that some mm-hmm. woo-woo crap I heard? I mean, I don't know.
I think that's true as far as we know. Yeah.
It's definitely more true than it is woo-woo.
Yeah.
Hey, well, woo-woo can be true.
I don't know exactly what it means, but yeah, that's where it comes from.
Yeah. So let's talk, we started getting into it in the core episode or the free portion of the episode, and you shared a very interesting article with us about the Masonic implications or whatever word we want to use of specifically the cask of Amontillado, but it tells us a lot about what Poe knew. So let's talk about this. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. So there's reason to when what I want to talk about first is my favorite obscure yet very influential event in American history. Are you guys familiar at all with the murder of Captain William Morgan?
I wasn't. I read about it in that thing you sent and was just like, oh my gosh.
not the rum guy, not that right, Captain right. Morgan. This happened in 1826. So it's like around 20 years before Poe had written Amontillado, but I think back then, the memory for these events was probably a little bit longer than it is now without a 24-hour news cycle and things like that. This happened in upstate New York. There was a man who was being denied admittance to some of the Masonic lodges there, even though he claimed that he had been a very high-level initiated member in Canada. And everything about Morgan and what he claimed about himself is actually in dispute by somebody. Nobody really knows about his background. Like, they don't know if he actually was a captain or he was just a big talker. But he decided to take revenge on the people he felt was some of the locals he felt were turning him away and said, okay, I'm going to write a tell-all book about the Masons, giving away all the secrets. Now, this is a huge no-no. You swear not to reveal this stuff on pain of death, or at least you used to. And so, but he got a publisher. He got an advance for it. He started, talking about it like this is the dumbest thing probably, but I guess he was probably trying to drum up interest in his book, but he hadn't published it. He hadn't published it yet. Yeah, he was a real diva. And so what happened to him before the book came out is he was arrested on some charges of borrowing a shirt and not taking it back. Very minor, like debt stuff. He was arrested and thrown in jail. His publisher bailed him out. He was rearrested. And then a group of men showed up when the jailer was away. They talked to the jailer's wife and convinced her to let him out. He went away with a group of men and was never, ever seen again. Some months later, a body was recovered from the Niagara River, and this was declared to be William Morgan. A bunch of local men, all Freemasons, were arrested. I don't remember the numbers. A bunch of people were put on trial. Only a few were convicted, and they got very light sentences. This was a national scandal. Everybody was learning about this. They realized that the Masons had too much political power. The mayor was a Mason. All these people were Masons. Now, the body that had washed up was later claimed by someone. The clothes were identified as someone in Canada. So that may not have been William Morgan, but this is early 19th century. It was not that easy to definitively identify a person, even recovering an entire body. They couldn't do DNA. They probably couldn't recover good finger. Or I don't even think they did fingerprinting at the time. So there's a lot of stories about, because some of the guys, they said, well, here's what we did. We got him and we paid him a bunch of money to just leave the country and never come back. And they said, you know, some people said that he went off and became a pirate and all this stuff, but it's all speculation. But what this inspired was a political party called the Anti-Masonic Party, which has got to be the most honest political party that has ever been formed. It's like, our thing is we don't like these guys
right
over there. You know, like nobody right. says that, even though that's most of what politics is.
Yeah.
We don't like those people over there.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, and running all the way through to President Kennedy, he was talking about secret societies and men who meet in secret and everything. So this is a thread all through American politics.
Definitely.
Yeah.
This was the first like big third party, and they got some traction, especially in New York, where they were actually like, I can't remember. I think, it wasn't, so there were the Democrats and there were the Republicans, but I think they were called something slightly different than just Republicans. But at any rate, they were in New York, the anti-Masons were more popular than the Democrats.
Wow.
At that time.
Wow.
Eventually they kind of withered away and got absorbed into the Whig Party. This was a major thing. And by the time Poe was writing the story, the kind of the anti-Masonic issue had kind of like subsided to the pressing issue of the day, which was slavery. But people definitely probably would have remembered the Morgan murder. And or supposed murder, we actually don't know, but people believe that at the time. There's a statue of William Morgan in Batavia, New York, where this happened.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I've been to Batavia. Interesting. Yeah,
it's a big deal. And one of the interesting things is
hang on. I'm sorry, I'm on his Wikipedia now, and you know you're gonna have a good story when it's born. Here, I'm gonna read it right now. This is too funny. Born 1774. Disappeared circa 1826.
Right.
Hell yeah. That's what I want for our podcast. Just right. The Art of Darkness podcast, Wikipedia.
Nobody really knows what happened.
Yeah.
So here's the funny thing. He had done a number of jobs. People dispute the fact that he had, like he said, he was a captain. People dispute that. He definitely was a brewer at a time. Another job that he had was as a bricklayer. I found out. Now, that's very
Mason.
Interesting. Yeah. So that rung a bell from Amontillado because of Montresor's being a literal bricklayer versus Fortunato's, a more speculative Mason.
When that moment he whips the trowel out. Yes, I'm a Mason. Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, so like revenge is the theme here too. Like this is a story of revenge. The paper that I sent you was called "The Poe and the American Affiliation with Freemasonry" by Robert Con Davis Undiano. You don't really know who that guy is. I just happened to find this. But so my initial take on the Masonry references was that Poe's taking like the anti-Masonic stance here, but what this guy claims is actually what this is referring to is a rivalry within Masonry, Freemasonry in early America that had to do with Masonic groups that were referred to as the Ancients and the Moderns. And it's a little bit confusing because the actual situation is reversed from the name, because the Ancients are actually the new guys, and the Moderns are the older, more established. So I guess the idea is that Montresor is, see, again, I'm getting things flipped around. Is he claiming that Montresor is an ancient? And that
Montresor is the guy who does the killing, right?
Yes, he's the one that does the killing.
So he would be the ancient, which is actually the newer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fortunato, of course, meaning fortunate. The ancients, i.e. the newer American Masons, were more working class, really. And this is actually kind of like a class battle in between interior to Freemasonry. And one of his big pieces of evidence for this is, an interpretation of the line at the very end of the story, because he takes him down into the wine cellar, and there's literally a pile of bones. Like he takes him past like in the tombs, there are people like in the walls and stuff, but then when you get to the bottom, it's just an disorganized pile of bones. Mm-hmm. And also this bricks, and then he walls him up in the wall, and I guess pushes the bone, covers it with bones. And he says, against the new masonry, I erected the old pile of bones, and they have remained undisturbed for so many years hence. And he takes the line against the new masonry as being against the moderns, the ancients against the moderns. It's an interesting line.
For sure.
However, I mean, you could take it too as like, because one of the problems they had with masonry is they took it as being anti-Christian, like anti-democratic and anti-Christian. This is one of the big controversies of masonry. Mm-hmm. You know, it's taking place during Carnival, which is preceding Lent. This is the big festival preceding Lent, and he's literally going into a catacomb, which is the hideout of the Christians during their persecution. And so that could be referenced to that as well.
Great.
But I believe the Cask of Amontillado is just full of interesting little signs and symbols to kind of look at. There's the Montresor, they go past the Montresor coat of arms, which is the, there's a foot stamping on a snake, and the snake is biting the don't tread on me thing. Yeah. And the snake is biting the heel, and it's the Latin motto, nobody attacks me with impunity, which actually happens to be the Scottish royal old family, like the ruling family of Scotland. They're like motto as well. It's like has some relationship with Scotland, which actually Scotland has like a interesting role to play in the history of Freemasonry and secret societies too, given the fact that of course you have like the Scottish Rite and so on. Yeah. But like it is believed in occult lore that Scotland was the hideout of the surviving Templars when they were rounded up by the prince was it Philip, I think, of France, when they rounded up the Templars. So
man. So Poe has got all of this sort of at his fingertips, right? And you know, with this new lens, I mean, if a side project I could envision for myself is going back over some of the Poe stories and looking for further signs of this that I may have missed. You know, I clearly missed all of it reading the first time I read Cask of Amontillado. Like I said, I kind of thought of this as something of a minor Poe work. And, you know, obviously some of that is just taste, but understanding that there's a much more intricate project at work underneath the hood of this fairly straightforward revenge tale. It's fascinating.
Well, one of the first things that kind of like got me interested in the idea that there may be some coded things going on in Poe was when I revisited a few years ago. I spent all of one October, you know, reading through a bunch of Poe stuff, and I noticed his affinity for the number 7. Seven is a very overloaded, you know, symbolic number. Of course, it's, you know, it's a magical number, but it's all over the place. So if you go back and read anything, just watch out for the number 7. Even in the Cask of Amontillado, he starts laying the layers of bricks. Yeah. And he stops at the 7th level, and he has a little exchange with Fortunato, and then he keeps going, and he tells us that he winds up with 11 levels.
Huh, interesting.
So I don't know entirely what's going on there, but I just noticed the 7 number cropping up.
It has some significance for him, yeah.
Yeah, because it's all over the place. And this notion of a code kind of pops up here and there. One of my there's some good a good resource for Poe stuff, and especially like some of the Eureka stuff explaining it, is a website called PoeDecoder.com.
Oh, okay, cool.
And I found a little thing written by a guy who was going to do like a master's thesis on Eureka and abandoned it because he just decided it was too hard. And he was kind of like, his essay was like, here's what you would need to know in order to begin doing a study of Eureka. And but I took note of this little passage that he said, just kind of by the by. It is possible then that Poe wrote Eureka as a puzzle and left obscure clues for his readers to solve, like he had done in his earlier cryptography newspaper columns. And I think you referred to this in your episode.
Yeah.
He did this in the newspaper. He had people send him like cryptograms to solve, and he would solve them. So he was really into that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
However, solutions to the puzzles and mystery Poe posed in Eureka have evaded researchers and readers for almost 170 years.
Yeah. Wow. There's something almost existentially sad about somebody assembling an incredibly ornate, maybe that's not the word, but somebody crafting this incredibly intricate puzzle, and then nobody even tries to solve it or something.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's kind of reflective of how I feel like Poe probably felt about his whole life. There's like this element of like, do these people know what I'm fucking brilliant? Can
yes.
anybody give me some props for this? Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting. Well, one of these days I'm going to at least get a copy of Eureka. This seems like a fascinating kind of thing to have and leaf through and contemplate for sure.
Yeah, you could be Eureka posting and I'll be posting the Dune coloring book.
There you go. Right,
you go.
Right, right, right,
right. Yeah.
One thing I wanted to note about maybe we kind of mentioned it, but I wanted to stress what I thought was fascinating is in that Poe and Masonry article you linked, he puts a lot of emphasis on the idea that at the time of Poe's writing, the average person would have had a lot more fluency with the symbology of Masonry, and it would have been a lot more obvious to them. And it's almost like a sort of a lost dialect. That people now, it kind of just passes, right over them. And the one thing I was fascinating, and Kevin, maybe you know this, I definitely did not know this, was about Masonry basic, you know, at the country's founding. Let me just read this little
oh,
bit.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Quote, for some perspective on the importance of Freemasonry in American culture, picture an early scene in the history of the Republic, the dedication of the new United States Capitol building in Washington, D.C. on September 18, 1793. President George Washington stands in front of a crowd dressed in his Masonic apron as he places a silver plate over the Masonic cornerstone of the Capitol. He then covers the cornerstone with corn, oil, and wine, Masonic symbols of consecration, and dedicates the building in, quote, the 13th year of American independence and in the year of Masonry, 5793. The image of America's first president acting like an ancient priest as he consecrates the country in the name of Freemasonry is striking and possibly would be a surprise to a great many people. But while Washington was an equally prominent and famous Mason among the Republic's founders, there were many Masons in the professional and upper end of the American working class of this period. Paul Revere, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, and Thomas Paine among them. Yeah.
What if I told you? Okay. So hang tight.
Right.
What if I told you not a Christian country?
Ooh.
Has never been a Christian country. The government has never been, obviously, Christian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
People make a terrible, terrible mistake when they emphasize and reemphasize that. A Christian country probably wouldn't let it get to where we are. I'll just leave it there. I'm just going to leave it there. Okay.
This is what Harold Bloom claims also in The American Religion, that it was never a Christian country. It's its own thing. He says it's a form of Gnosticism. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly the right way to characterize it, but I think, yeah, it has its own religious sensibilities that are definitely different from traditional Christianity. I mean, look, I was raised in the Mormon church, which many people say is not Christian. And
you're talking to a couple of Catholics, man. They say the same thing about us, right? Which is crazy.
It's a weird beast, the Mormons. They've got some good things going for them, but yeah, I get that perspective. But at the same time, it's just like, it's, they're kind of like the blind man and the elephant in a weird way, because it is and it isn't, in the way that they mean it. But anyways, you know, so I was raised in the American religion, and it was also like, can be considered in a way like a Freemasonry offshoot, you know, that really took root when it went west. I mean, well, Joseph Smith was briefly a Mason. He definitely took some of the rituals from that. The Mormon temple rituals reflect Masonic. They used to reflect it more so. It used to be basically like a knockoff of Freemasonic rituals. Joseph Smith came out of the very same area of upstate New York as William Morgan. Palmyra, I don't think, is too far from there. Here's a little odd footnote. William Morgan's widow may have wound up becoming one of Joseph Smith's plural wives later. Whoa. She definitely fell into the orbit of the Mormons through a man that she married later. So, yeah.
Wow.
That's how closely tied in some of this stuff is.
Yeah, this is like secret history of America stuff here. Yeah, I love it.
But I wanted to say, this is an important aspect of the Cask of Amontillado is he also claims that the whole like journey that he takes Fortunato on toward his demise reflects Masonic ritual as well. It's really like an inversion of it. Like in the same way that the trowel is, right? And it's funny, I actually like Googled Morgan's book, and the first quote that came up was how he was talking about the trowel being like a symbol of brotherhood, which of course is a symbol of quite the opposite in the Cask of Amontillado, right? And so Poe is actually literally like inverting all these Masonic things. He takes him down, takes Fortunato down a winding stair, which is a descending winding stair. The second degree of Freemasonry initiation has you going up a winding stair to a middle chamber. There's a set number of steps that goes 3, 5, and 7, which are these symbolic numbers. You know, you've got 3 degrees of Masonry. There's many, many, many other associations with three. Every lots of these elements in here, and also the fact that this is all oriented around wine, you know, that is very significant for religious ritual. You know, obviously you have the sacrament with the wine, and even you could talk about like ancient Dionysian and those sort of mystery cults that were oriented around wine.
100%. Yeah, this is fascinating stuff. I mean. Yeah. It's easy to dismiss now. The Freemasons now, because I know people who are members of lodges and stuff, and it kind of is sort of, it seems like they just sort of hang out and drink beer, and then they have like, you know, various civic functions that they do.
It's more for local politics than you think. I mean, the hospital they're a big force over in Minneapolis. I mean, the hospital my son was born into, you know, is a Masonic hospital. They do a lot of, they have a lot of children's hospitals. They do an extraordinary amount of charity, and they have a degree of political power because they're a big institution. So, you know, it's not like, you know, I don't think you get entered in and then suddenly your life changes, you know, and you're welcomed into, you know, the governor's mansion or anything.
It's
a network, but
numbers did fall off after this period of reaction against them, but they were extremely powerful at the time.
Never go away. Very interesting. Well, I think we'll close it down there. Thank you for bringing all this stuff to us, Allison. Thanks for being such a like, you've brought untold value to the Art of Darkness archive, library, whatever we're calling it. So I much appreciate that.
The vault.
Put it in the vault. Hey, how about this? Yeah. Cryptocracy, anybody?
Cryptocracy, you
know, the cryptocracy. Okay,
anyway. I like that.
Are you talking about I like this. You're talking about revelation of the method and everything. I have an idea for another podcast I want to do, but that's a totally different. I want to do a podcast called Doom Scroll. Where the idea for the show would be we would we would not prep very much, and we would just read the trending topics on Twitter and then the trending topics on LinkedIn. and then just rip it. It would just be horrible. Pure coal. But I second everything that Brad said. Al, this is, you're a great guest, and you're welcome anytime. So much fun.
I was honored. It is a lot of fun.
Forest of Symbols podcast. Go and get it. And thank you, Patreon. Yes, thank you, Substack. Please. Thank you, Substack. Thank you, Patreon. Good. More stuff coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.